James, we have another listener question. They've sent in their question via everythinghurts.com, where you can send in your questions either via text or an audio question. But this is a text question, James. Another great question from one of our listeners.
So it gets read out in your voice.
Yeah.
Whoever sent this think that I might be sick of your voice at this point. Actually, you know what?
Send in your audio questions.
Yeah, never mind. It's not just that I'm sick of Dan's voice. He also appears to be aging in reverse. Now he's got his hair plugs. It's so much.
I mean, a turkey.
Yeah. He's gone to the turkeys. He's got himself a new head. It's all store bought. Yeah. It's off the rack, but it's not bespoke. I'm thinking of getting Madonna's brow ridge myself to take me from the present sort of Cro-Magnon vibe that I'm working with now. I thought I might get something a little bit more Hollywood and contemporary. Maybe some fiberglass arms, a new set of ankles. Feet are popular on the internet. And I don't think men's 12 and a half with busted veins and calluses and stuff is really what they've got in mind. So I'm thinking of getting a pair of 22-year-old Norwegian feet, Dan. So next time you're at the feet store, once you're over the fact that you've bought yourself new hair, you should definitely direct me to a pair of internet-capable feet.
You'll be a cross-country skiing expert.
Oh, wouldn't
think about that.
Wouldn't that be amazing if you could ship a thesis yourself and the parts themselves came with inherent abilities? That'd be amazing. I get Tommy Hearn's left arm. I get Deontay Wilder's right arm. And I would just walk around punching trees. No one knows who those people are because I'm the only person.
Who are these people?
I'm the only person in the world that still actually watches boxing. Just play the fucking question before I start assembling a horrible homunculus, will you?
Here is a question which I'll read out. Okay. How useful are experiences and practices from other research fields for the behavioral sciences? For example, the behavioral sciences often look to physics as an example for how preprints worked well. But just because it's worked for physics, should we automatically think that this should work for the behavioral sciences? What are some things from other fields that have transferred well or should transfer well, and some things that are not working well or will not work well?
That is one of the best fucking questions we've ever had. That is such a good question. Is it anonymous? Is there someone out there who needs anonymous props? Well, anonymous person, that's an absolute fucking blinder. Okay. So much stuff immediately comes to mind. Rather than me talking for 20 minutes and getting increasingly strident, I'll just pick one. Okay?
Okay.
Okay, so over the last 10 to 15 years, commercial and university labs in the life sciences have both suddenly stumbled across the fact that keeping laboratory records is future-proofing experiments. It is ensuring the inherent value of observations that you take. It is hedging against someone leaving and someone new starting the same project or getting hit by a bus or running off to start a scuba school in Costa Rica or any number of other sensible decisions that don't involve getting a PhD in biology, which is, of course, largely sitting down and crying in the vicinity of a centrifuge. So one of the things that's become very popular, and now I think within people who I know, I think it's fair to say now that this is completely ubiquitous, is electronic lab management software. So
it's not just a Boston thing. This is international.
It's not just a Boston. It's not just a Boston thing, because people who are here also often come from elsewhere. And obviously, but this, you know, you can't move in this town without stumbling over someone in a biotech company. This is just one of the things that the city does really well. Partly that's the universities, partly that's historical, partly it's because I think it's been strongly encouraged. There are a variety of reasons. So These are also innovations that have successfully bridged the divide between I have a small startup, I have an enormous laboratory, and I have an academic laboratory of any size, which is somewhere between one person sitting in a corner to a multi-site 60, 80 person group full of people who some of whom barely know each other. Like at that point in time, you're getting towards a sort of mid-sized company, same kind of budget, same amount of people, etc. And I think it's reasonably common for people to come out of academia and go straight into a commercial environment, or occasionally the other way around, but not often, and have exactly the same sort of system and environment and expectations waiting for them. And these are used properly, of course. I think that's a caveat here. These are hugely beneficial. There's none of this extra special nonsense on the basis of what happened 8 months ago when Sandra was working on it, because I need to give explicit instructions to Deirdre now. None of that horse shit. They're very, very good. And I think there are a few cultural differences that come along with the use of these as well. I don't even need to outline why this is a good idea. There's some features in Qualtrics that are like this, that allow the similar sorts of data retention to happen. We know that if you've used it, obviously. But also, if you've read any of the stories about people who got busted for changing the data that later came in, it used to be saved in the Qualtrics in the first place. That's one of the benefits they offer.
It's all saved.
Yeah. These are great. And even as recently, I mean, there's probably still people out there with a laboratory notebook and a mechanical pencil and a piece of paper, you know, with that fucking S that everyone drew at primary school, scratched into the margin, a derogatory B. But in general, I think it makes everyone's life easier. It makes it easier to manage people. It makes it easier to be managed. You want to show that you've actually done what you're supposed to. You've got something to point to. And there's a tremendous sanity-giving aspect to all of it within an organization of any size. I think where the cultural difference comes in is that it's easy to teach biologists that there is a new system with which they should exercise their customary attention to detail. And anyone who has within the behavioral sciences who's ever submitted a sheet called laboratory data final 2, 3, 4, actually really final, I mean it this time, _V4.
It's a screenshot of an Excel spreadsheet.
Yeah. Yeah. So, standardizing that, if you have a lot of experimentation going on, like heavily standardizing and organizing the system of access, system of mutual compliance, I suppose, and being able to maintain that is really, it's really beneficial. And it's a great example of something that has evolved to fit the space without being particularly flashy, without engaging any of the nonsense of the publication system, where it was just so necessary that this became ubiquitous that it eventually did. It's one of these fucking quiet innovations in a sort of picks and shovels kind of company, where someone had a good idea and then everyone else agreed that it was a good idea because it made their lives easier and they all started paying for it. So I confine myself to one, Dan. So that's my first one. Over to you and your fresh hair. It's fresh, kids. It is also dope and fly.
That's an interesting example because it seems to have come about. You didn't have to twist people's arms to make this happen. And it seems to have come about due to necessity. And it's come about due to necessity, but it's also beneficial in a number of other ways. And I think, yeah, a good example, at least within behavioral sciences, is Qualtrics, how it has this automatic collection or data auditing. I think also within clinical trials, which are carefully monitored, there is an independent monitor who actually goes through and checks these things. So that's something that is kind of borrowed from at least medicine in which there's a real big need to actually look at data compliance. So this is sort of happening from two different fronts. But that's a really good example.
That being said, Dan, bear in mind also that compliance rules change from country to country, and also some compliance monitoring is better than others. Let's not dig into that particular bucket. But given the amount of terrible, dodgy RCTs that have occurred, particularly over the last 5 years, give or take, there's obviously many, many places in the world, some of which would surprise you, where there is a dire lack of the oversight that you're describing.
Given the new regulations within the EU, the amount that needs to be done, I would at least trials at a beginning around about now and that are reported in a couple of years' time, I think would be extremely trustworthy given the amount of work that needs to be done, at least within the EU, for a clinical trial. So I think it's the extra sort of regulatory stuff is annoying. I'm in the midst of this, thinking about the stuff that needs to be done, but it is going to make for much more credible science. So I'm not sure what things are like in the States right now. Maybe it's the same.
I haven't had any direct contact with a clinical trial for quite some time, but certainly I get to hear about the ways that they go wrong from time to time. It's a sort of downstream effect of something being awful. I do not think the practice of it here certainly is anywhere near as good as the idea of it is over there. I had an additional point to put on top of that you provoked. And now I've forgotten what it is because it's 4,000 degrees in Boston today. If you could fly here,
I'm sure it'll come back.
With infinite steak, you could start a barbecue simply by the meat existing outdoors. It'd be a beautiful medium rare.
Just laid out there.
2.5 minutes, just sitting on an old boot on a driveway.
Is it like the old Sydney weather where you couldn't walk out barefoot?
It often is here. It's often quite nice overnight. The problem is that it gets warm early and it stays warm late. So I think there's a strong bolus of warm. Also, bear in mind the days are really long at this time of year, so there's plenty of warm to go around. That's why I'm forgetting my side points, Dan. I have no intention of trying to remember it. I'll just come up with a new one at this point. Gonna lean into the old today. Go talk.
I think there's a few good things that are out there. I want to start with a thing that I think is not a great innovation, which might not necessarily suit the behavioral sciences. And I think this is already happening in sub fields, and that's blinded reviews. I don't think that reviews in which you're peer reviewing a paper and that the authors attempt to blind themselves is a good idea because I don't think it works. I occasionally peer review papers in journals where this is either a requirement or this is an option. And every single time without fail, either the journal screws up somehow and they include the cover letter which includes the author's names in the cover letter so that the blind is blown, or it's extremely obvious within the actual paper and they're doing like all these sort of backflips to attempt to hide who they are, but you figure out who they are basically straight away. I know there are certain benefits. I've been at the bad end of people making assumptions about who I am. I've told this story before about submitting a paper 10, 15 years ago. It was me with a few other co-authors with not white surnames. And we were told by the reviewers to get our English proofread by native English speakers, despite the fact we're all born in Australia.
I've criticized you for being occasionally incoherent over a period of years, but there's fucking limits, you know?
There's limits.
I don't think there's anything particularly problematic about your written English. Certainly, you have the patience.
It's possible.
Yeah. that's just rude, man.
It's possible. So, look, I get the idea behind it and that this could potentially reduce some biases, but I think it simply doesn't work, and it just puts a burden on authors who have to redo their papers. It also sort of defeats the purpose of preprints, because once a preprint is out there, I don't think there's any system where you can submit an anonymous preprint. It's just the benefits of having public papers with names on it outweigh the potential upsides, because I think it's extremely difficult to do this. So I know this is very popular in some fields and within some subfields of the behavioral sciences, but I just don't think it works. So I don't think this is one of those things that we should do on a large scale, at least within psychology.
Okay. So presumably that's what behavioral scientists should, the example that they should be taking from elsewhere is the fact that this isn't any good and everyone else has discarded it.
I think it's still happening within some
fields. Otherwise, you've reframed the question.
The question talked about some things which we should bring in and some things we should not. Like what sort of stuff should work and sort of stuff shouldn't work.
Fair call. All right.
Yeah.
I have to say,
yeah, so that is.
I've had exactly the same experience with that. I don't know whose job it is to actually do the blinding, but when you have a complicated 6,500-word document, it is actually something of an arse ache, even if it's relatively simple, to redact every single detail of every single thing that is a reference to the authors. And if it's an ongoing research program, how the fuck are you supposed to ferret all of it out? I've only had, I think, maybe three ever papers with it. But I do remember it being obvious in every single occasion. One of which was simply the fact that in a particularly dense paragraph, they just straight up forgot to remove one of the references. So, you know, it was anonymous. You get to page 7 and then it's like, well, here it's a bunch of these guys. There's a group of Japanese authors I'd never heard of. I'm not sure what blinding would have done on that basis anyway. I mean, if it's a heads against shittiness, then you can have less information or you can have more information. If shittiness is occurring in a certain information environment, you can protect everyone, like a Delphi process about it, trying to make decision-making fairer by structuring it under limited information about parties. Or you can protect people by making it more explicit. And I think pretty much everywhere that is in behavioral sciences has decided that making it more explicit is much easier than trying to prevent every single reference of something that people have done over a very long period of time. I mean, it could also forget about it if you were ever motivated to find out. If you cared about it, I mean, I've never given a shit in a situation like that. So, oh, were these people my concerted enemies from Azerbaijan? I need to frantically Google around and see who signed these papers before. No, fuck that. I don't know. Maybe if it could be opt-in, but I don't know. I don't see a great benefit. Yeah, maybe people in much more contentious fields would disagree. I don't know.
Yeah.
If someone wants to, I will 100% listen to someone make a strong case for the blended peer review. But I think that people are, the discussions about it, the impetus to try to determine whether or not it's a good idea, pushing for it on a policy level, I've seen very little of that in the recent past. And I think that's because it was a nice idea in some respects. I think it was brought in on the basis of trying to be fair. And we're allowed to have any damn idea we like. And once we test it and it doesn't work, then often that could be the end of it. Do you know what I'd like to see more of as well?
Okay.
Now, this is, you might be a little bit surprised by this. I think it's often in medicine, sometimes in sports science, sometimes you occasionally see this at the more clinical end. It's not really the behavioral sciences, it's sort of a clinical treatment of psychiatric or psychological conditions. You do see more very small N studies that have a very high degree of observation. There are whole books written on how to measure and sample very small amounts of people. And certainly in the history of physiology, single point studies are very, very well known. So limited observations have made big contributions to theory and practice. And I think sometimes people completely confuse the broad applicability of something with the fidelity of being able to measure something. I think there is a space for more almost narrative-driven work where you have aggressive sampling, oversampling even, of single points. I mean, let's say, for instance, that we're tracking the relationship between mood and a physiological variable in a single person. It would not be tremendously difficult or unusual to think about multi-day sampling for 300 days straight or something similar. And so you've hugely oversampled that relationship. And that is not the same as an anecdote at that point. I think people think that carefully constructed single observations are essentially stories. And I'm not convinced that there's absolutely no value to stories. Certainly, I mean, they have a ton. People are going to have this so much bullshit narrative power in people who are in the pseudoscience and sort of science adjacent media in general. I honestly would like to see more case studies, and I would hope that they would be directly influenced by the better ones that are in medicine, because better case studies, better medical case studies are really fucking detailed. Some of them throw the full works, the absolute kitchen sink at people. And at the very least, this is something as well, because it's actually a human story at that point. I think there's something compelling about it as a document, as much as obviously the broader applicability is limited. But if you establish something where you're reasonably sure about the causality, and you can be with a big enough change and enough measurement and presumably enough time, you can be reasonably sure that there is a direction of causation involved. And it's very hard to get people to do hard, long, irritating things. Very hard. And maybe a couple of motivated individuals or a few people who don't have a choice maybe represent a better measurement environment for some stuff. I don't know. I've often thought about it. And in different rare, diseasey things, and certainly in sort of behavioral neurology, I think it's reasonably common to say, you know, we had three people who were a very long way down the autistic spectrum, and we studied them as much as possible for 6 months. I think that's when your axis goes down, it's much more normal to think of research being valid in those terms. And it's just a mechanism, I think, is in the age of being able to mass collect data, I think it's sort of lost a degree of respectability. But at the same time, the ability to mass collect data a lot of the time is the ability to mass assemble an enormous pile of shit. Oh, we've got a thousand points, and many of them are terrible, and then we took a whole bunch of measurements and we have absolutely nothing that's pre-specified. We have a multiplicative or borderline exponent amount of possible analyses, and we did exactly four of those, and we'll now pretend that that's what we meant to do all along. It's classic fucking B hacking. So it's you know, it's you don't get a free pass. And if someone else did a study with 80 people, if you do it with 800, you don't become right by definition just because more motherfuckers showed up and signed something. Shit is always going to be shit. You remember the Darren Daly's pyramid of evidence? And at the top it says intelligent, well-designed studies. And then under that it says all the other shit.
Yeah.
As opposed to just like starting off with anecdotes and going to laboratory observations and then go to people and then go to RCTs and then go to fucking medicine.
That bloody pyramid. Yeah. I hate that pyramid.
The pyramid is...
Meta-analysis, the top.
Yes, you know it was a meta-analyst who came up with that fucking pyramid. It had to be. It had to be. By the way, our ability to use space magic to determine the music of the spheres and combine all the other nonsense into one particularly sensible observation. Only we truly. It's probably someone from Cochrane. Emphasis on the cock.
Yes. We have to find the source of the original author of the evidence pyramid.
Yeah.
And then
in a fit of great irony, bury them at the bottom of a pyramid.
I want to talk about something similar to that. I read a preprint a couple of weeks ago, which was looking at the degree of pre-registration of meta-analysis within psychology. They looked at studies published, all psychology studies published, I think it was in like 2021 or 22, a couple of years ago. And the percentage of these that were actually pre-registered was like 20% or 30%. It was ridiculously low. So this is something that we absolutely need. I believe these figures are higher for medicine, for medical outcomes, where it's basically the norm for big medical journals. You cannot publish, your JAMAs, for instance, you cannot publish a meta-analysis unless it's been pre-registered. But to get a rate of 20 to 30% is ridiculously low and so open to bias. When it comes to decisions for, you know, how you actually do the analysis there. So that's a very quick one that we can actually take from medicine, which is at least the policing of pre-registration, because it's so low. And I knew it was bad, but it's so much lower than I thought.
Yeah. I would add a component to that. The amount of people that I've busted or made uncomfortable by looking at their clinical trial registration and then figuring out what they did later was not congruent with the clinical trial registration is profound. The main problem with any of this, and I don't think there's a really good determination whether or not either of these things work, or 20 or 30% is good, whether that 20 or 30% are actually following their protocol, and likewise within medicine. I think we've created something that is almost a kind of caviar-ass legalistic framework where it exists because it's supposed to. And there are occasions where people want to go back and look at what is in that pre-registration and use it to say something about the paper, but they usually happen after the fact. I often, there's a paper a few years ago that basically said, oh, the quality of pre-registered studies isn't any better, so it was a failed experiment. I never put much stock in it because I don't think people are carefully reading the pre-registration. I don't think it's being considered as part of the publication process. I think people who do review have a way that they've always done review, which is read the fucking thing and then react to it. Like you have a light sensitive stalk instead of a fucking brain and just inch yourself closer to the light. And we are absent the cultural change to put more time and structure into peer reviewing. Right? I mean, there's ways you could get that. So like pay me, for instance, and I promise you I'll do a better job and read every pre-registration. Other people may as well, especially if you make it a fucking condition for payment. That's the nice thing about payments is you get to specify what you want rather than, here you go, you'll figure it out. You know, you have the ability to form a contract. Well, we could already do that. You fucking don't. And so you want an opportunity to actually get the ability to tell people to do what you want. I strongly recommend signing a fucking contract with them. Anyway, so I still don't think we know a great deal about it, simply because a lot of errors and a lot of non-compliance with pre-registration hides in plain sight without consequences. I think that's the best way I can phrase it.
Well, it's all there. It's easy enough to look at the paper, compare it against. I think this actual paper, of the 20% of ones that actually pre-registered, they took a closer look, and almost all of them had some sort of unreported deviation. Some were larger, some were smaller. And I don't necessarily think that people are on purpose being sketchy. Maybe they are. Maybe there's a small percentage of people. But I think, yeah, these things are happening because there's no careful oversight. And of course, you know, we've spoken about it a million times before in different episodes. Registered reports go a very long way of solving this, because part of the review process is actually checking against the pre-registration from both the editors and the reviewers. So
yeah, this is a good way because it's making it something conditional on the registration process itself. That is part of the evaluative sphere. Sounds like the world's shittest ride at Disneyland. Ride the evaluative sphere. You'll just go round and round and round. Oh, dear. Well, I mean, it's nice. It's nice to think about all of these innovations, isn't it? What else can we get? I mean, we can get the budgets from High Energy Felix. You get the budgets from quantum computing. Yeah, that'd be a good laugh. I don't know.
I want to get an old school one.
Yeah, go on, have another. Have another. Deploy haircut.
Okay. Go. Here's one, and I'm not sure whether this is some sort of like availability bias heuristic going on, but the clear writing of philosophy. Quite often, I've seen a few philosophers that have sort of jumped in to write psychology papers, and I think this writing is incredibly clear how they actually structure the arguments, and I actually enjoy reading the papers. These are from people who are like actually from philosophy departments, and maybe it's because of the history of how they have to write their papers within hardcore philosophy journals. I don't know. Just the times that I've read philosophers who are...
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. And a lot of the time, there's a beautiful clarity to it. I would say that I think, Dan, that psychology and the other behavioral sciences have a writing culture and that philosophy has an editing culture.
Okay.
I think they are closer to authors and journalists in the way that they treat text. A lot of the time, I think it's far more likely that someone reads what they've written and is critical over the ability to communicate. And I think that is simply inherent because that's all they have. And if someone's helping you with something, you get edits that say, I don't understand this. This isn't clear. This point is good. This doesn't make sense. I don't understand how this follows from the previous paragraph. I think you become a better draftsman at the process. I think there is editing that is inherent to the process that is missing from, if you slap it all out in the right order and you cite the right shit, then there will be inherent value in the fact that you are presenting data and giving context through the extensive referencing. And occasionally you come across science that's blindingly clear, but I think it would be very unfair to say that there was a difference in complexity sufficient that, say, the social behavioral sciences were studying something that was of more complexity than poor old modern philosophers out there doing a research, dropping a knowledge. I think that would be very unfair to say. In fact, to be quite honest, I would posit, using terrible language, that it was often the other way around. I think at this point in time in our podcast arc, everyone knows what I think about that. At the very least, if you want an actionable version of that, I would say steal. But this is the advice you always get as a musician. Find something that you like from someone else and rip it off. It could be anything. It could be a structure. It could be a turn of phrase. It could be the way that ideas are signposted between paragraphs. Steal that. And then go to someone else's work and steal something else and continue to purloin these pieces one after the other, like you're building a giant mannequin out of deli meats to make a horrible flesh monster. And when you set your flesh monster free and con the world, and you write the word for golem on their head, and it strides the landscape, punching hams through people's driver's side windows and shaking them upside down for spare change, you will know that you have truly left your mark upon this world.
All right. Other examples of things that we should keep doing, we should take from other fields, or things from other fields that we should not do. Perhaps we can briefly talk about this whole preprint thing. People often point to Physics Archive, jumped up in the, or at least appeared in the 90s, and a lot of arguments about the success of preprints in different research fields often point to, well, it worked within physics. Scooping is not a problem within physics because of preprints, so it's not going to be a problem in your field. Or within physics, there wasn't a flood of people obviously just posting.
Right. I feel like one of the perpetual barriers to preprint adoption is the ability to grasp inherent knowledge or inherent arguments within something that's in front of you. It's obviously very common in maths as well. You just dump the paper, and after 100 people in the world who give a fuck about your particular flavor of set theory will look at it. I think it's different when someone can look at your paper and they can follow the line of the argument in a way that doesn't require additional clarification. I think most lines of a proof are sufficiently well self-contained that the arguments that you'd have about it are different. And that forms a different communicative structure. I don't know if I'm expressing that well. I don't think it's always possible to produce something that is as good as it could be without other people looking at it. I mean, that's why we've always advocated for preprint it and then release it yourself. You've got to get people to read the motherfucker. You've actually got to, it doesn't matter how you do it, but it needs to be seen, and not just for your own personal gratification. There's a head check to make sure you haven't lost your damn mind completely. Just to make sure that a context is given to it. Yeah, look, I just mean, what is left to say about preprints that we haven't already said? I think that in many respects, the battle is largely over. It would be much easier in general for all journals to move to a platform where you just take a preprint and you literally tell the journal to turn up and review that whoever the fuck they like. It all depends. I do wonder sometimes. I have, even especially after the last couple of years, and I've been looking at some statements that some publishers have made fairly recently, and looking really carefully at some of the decisions. I do wonder if journal management software and the interface that's given to people who have to review things is just utterly without innovation because it's not their problem anymore. I think that there's so much within the publishing industry where the activities that are directly connected to revenue are insourced, taken seriously. They have people who are experienced set upon them, improving them, understanding how they should work and how they could work better. And everything else that is literally the entire content and mechanics is of much less interest to them. I mean, there was an interview recently. There was a response to a paper that Ivan from Retraction Watch wrote that was, I think it was the Wall Street Journal I'm going to say it was the Wall Street Journal. And there was a response to this from it was the Washington Post, wasn't it? Now I've said that. It doesn't matter. Fuck, it was in the newspaper. And there was a response that was given to it by someone from a journal who I now have a significantly diminished opinion of, if that was even possible in the first place. I'll read you some pieces of this out because it's funny, right? Publishers agree that paper mills, which try to subvert editorial practices to trick publishers into publishing fake science, are a real challenge to our community. But we would argue that we are far from being overwhelmed. So, right off the bat, I'll resist the temptation to call that bag of shit and confine myself to saying there's no publishers, plural, that includes all of them where that statement is in any way true. Maybe the larger ones to some extent, but there have been so many big hits for finding paper mill papers across the entirety of the publication spectrum, especially the absolute nonsense at Hindawi, which is probably, last time I checked, was, I think, 11,300 individual retractions. And that's
now
a Wiley problem, because while this was going on, they bought Hindawi. While this was happening during their due diligence process, this had started, and then this happened for 20 months while they had owned it as a property, and then they figured it out 20 months later. Would you say that they were absolutely dedicated to keeping this content out of their digital pages? Well, apparently Spring and Nature
are
absolutely dedicated to keeping their content out. They've invested millions of dollars in developing artificial intelligence technology to identify problematic content. And then here's the really fun part. Our research integrity unit identified and prevented publication of over 8,000 submitted papers with major integrity problems. This in no way is any information. How many would you have 8, rejected? 8,000
out of how many?
How many would you have rejected without that? How much crossover would there have been between the regular version of looking at that and something else? It's a good figure in complete isolation. But at the same time, I promise you this should happen. If you ask for any details about how that works, they'd say, well, we can't tell you because then the bad guys would know, and then they'd be able to circumvent our system, so it has to be a secret. Has anyone ever audited that? Have they seen your 8,000 papers and the reasons that you cite? Are you ever going to cite any substructure to that number? Was it 7,900 that had dodgy language and then 100 that was something else? A free or nearly free version that you got from the problematic paper screener guys that could do the vast majority of this work before you spend millions of dollars that was actually important? Or like, what sort of efficiency does that represent? And how many do you think we could find if we looked in the absence of this? How many are you missing? Are you trying to find that out? I don't know. And this is the fun part at the end of the letter. Publishers are working hard to address these issues, but we cannot work in a vacuum. Blah, blah, blah. Committed to working together and hope the scientific community will agree that collaboration rather than criticism is the way forward. Now, that's probably one of the most offensive sentences about forensic metascience I've ever read in my entire fucking life. Because you generally spend most of your time fighting people at publishers to be able to make the points that you want to make and get the investigations that you want into things that can be investigated. And they should also be very, very aware by now that anyone who does that work has a very high hit rate is almost never wasting their time. Well over 90% in my experience when it comes to me. And I'd like to think that mine is 100. It's impossible to know, so I'm not going to make that fucking claim. See how easy that was, Captain 8000 Papers? So no one who is behind that curtain, no one who is behind the sort of veil of niceness, the sort of pretense that everything is fine within the publication industry ever talks to us. And then in response to a critical editorial about how publishers suck, and say, well, why can't we all work together? You have never attempted to do that with a broader community of people who work cleaning up your mess ever. And now you would like to be immune from criticism on the basis that if we all work together, it's easier. At the same time, all your little wizards fight us to a standstill. Why are we talking about this? Well, apart from the fact that it's irritating, it's on my fucking mind. This is why I don't think it's a problem to take a preprint and then say, all right, that's the submission. We're an overlay journal. Let's do that. Throw out the fucking JMS. Because this is the sort of environment, this is the kind of, it's like blithe, hand-waving, dishonesty bullshit. They're never going to sink $10 million into designing a better back end so editors can do their job in half the time. There's no fucking way. There's no fucking way they're going to do that because there's no money in it. It's just making work for someone else. I honestly think it would be almost as good considering some of these systems. And it would certainly be more honest and effective at the end considering that some of the systems are like the Frontier system, which doesn't let you reject articles at all, doesn't even let the associate editor reject articles at all in the ploy to keep as much money as possible. And I don't know. I think everyone has to face the reality that they don't give a fuck about you. They don't give a fuck about you. But at the same time, they hold all the things that you care about. So you can either figure out a way to change what you care. Oh, that's right. You can't. You were told not to. Or you can do something about it. What you can't do is get on social media and then tell me that something should happen. If you do that preemptively, and we can save this as a clip to use so I don't have to say it later, fuck you and fuck the word should. If you want something done, you do it yourself. Be a punk rocker. Stop being such a whiny little maggot and actually do something with your life. If it's also fucking terrible, go out and change how terrible it is. And don't come crying to me and telling me that what I'm working on isn't the thing that you think I should be working on when you haven't done any work on anything to try and ameliorate these problems anywhere, ever. This mic is expensive, so I'm not going to drop it, but I do realize we were talking about preprints. I may have gone slightly off topic there for a bit, but this is my hot,
that's all right.
This is my hot weather energy rant. You can tell that I'm lacking some of the sort of over articulation snippiness that I would normally be experiencing during cold weather. I realize that my mood is extremely variable. Anyone who's known me knows that I will range somewhere between surly and murderous to happy Labrador and everywhere in between. I've always envied people like you that in one expect, because it's very easy to know what you're going to get. When I'm going to talk to you, I know exactly how you're going to respond to different sorts of things. You're extremely consistent. And I know it must be horrible to be around me sometimes when I'm either going to like mutter at you or throw things, set your pants on fire, last time you fall over, or at the other end of the spectrum, leaning over your shoulder, telling you you've lost weight, admiring your cologne by sniffing your neck, asking if I can help with what you're working on, try to be your best friend, and generally not leaving you alone like a giant toddler. Just want to
you're predictably unpredictable.
Shout out there for it. Well, I'm afraid so, and I used to try to do something about that, and I don't always like landing on the It's just that the smooth greased rails of being a complete dick all the time, because I'm not. I've never managed to be emotionally consistent. It's not a it's not a gift that's being given to me. I only have this. Thank Christ, I hope at the very least I get to be intellectually consistent, but the other versions of it are, I don't even know what to say. And I'm not sure why I'm telling you this as a form of sort of public hurts-based apology for 6 years of awful behavior.
7 years, eight years.
Longer offline, yes.
Well, true. Historically, yeah. More than 12 years, 14 years, almost cracking 15 years.
Don't. I had to think about something the other day, and the answer to a question legitimately in my lifetime was 25 years. And I said that, and then I went, oh, Jesus. Okay, so this is what getting old feels like. I'm going to go to Turkey and buy some Dan hair.
That's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening to Everything Hurts. Keep sending in your questions, either via text or via audio, everythinghurts.com, and we will do our best to answer it in a future episode. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.